It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Tackling the controversies, engaging the culture, challenging the status quo, and taking your calls. Dr. Brown is the director of Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Call now at 866-34-TRUTH and get into the line of fire.
Yes, got it right. You are ready. I am ready. It is Friday, which means you've got questions. We've got answers here on the line of fire. Michael Brown, thanks so much for joining us. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884, or on Facebook, Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown, our fan page on Facebook. I'm going to be doing a special advance giveaway of my book, A Queer Thing Happened to America, due out probably February of next year, so just a few months from now. I've got a trivia question, something I just discovered last night, and I want to see if anyone has the answer to it. I've got a bigger than usual stack of email questions to get into, and some, was it email of the week? Now, I guess it's the post of the week. We got two posts that were just sent to me privately to look at. We have folks that moderate our different online sites, Voice of Revolution, Line of Fire, where folks can write in and post things, and there are certain rules. You can't use profanity. You can't attack people personally, etc. But otherwise, we let folks have at it. You can differ doctrinally. You can raise what points you want to raise and go for it. We'll not restrict that. In fact, we encourage it. But there are a couple that were over the top, inappropriate, couldn't be posted. But I want to read them to you. Obviously, I have to censor one as I go because of the language, just to take you behind the scenes here at the line of fire. All right. I'll give you the trivia question in a moment. But let me start with an email from Susan. I watched Dr. Brooks, just came in this morning. I watched Dr. Brown being interviewed by Dr. Seif, Jeff Seif, on Zola Levitt Presents. While speaking of his teaching, he mentioned something about how to memorize Scripture. Is this just a course in his classes, or is there a resource available for purchase that will help me to learn how to memorize Scripture? Thank you. Susan, I just kind of stumbled on these things alone when I was a new believer. In terms of ways to memorize, I absolutely do not have a system beyond what I'm about to tell you. I don't have anything written on it. I'm sure if you do a search for memorization or Bible memorization, you can find other authors, one of whom I know personally, that have written on this and who can recommend ways to do it. I've never succeeded doing it their way. I haven't applied myself heavily to do it their way. I have looked at it. At least a little bit, some of the other methods or picturing things a certain way or getting images in your mind that help you remember something. It hasn't helped me. But this much I know. I have friends who are ultra-Orthodox rabbis, very religious Jews, and they grew up with a certain system of study, and they have committed massive amounts of material to memory, and they've never heard of these other systems. So what I'm going to tell you is more in keeping with the way that they would do it, but what I stumbled on as a new believer. So I'm saved, out of heavy drug use, end of 1971 into 1972. I'm getting hungrier for the word. I'm just reading it more and more. And I developed a system by which, with God's grace, for 6 months without missing a day, I memorized 20 verses every day, and I could do it in 1 hour. And to this day, many of those verses remain clearly in my head with specific references, etc. And of course, I've learned others over the years. So it lasted, it worked. So first thing I did was I read the Word a lot. I read the Word 2 hours a day. Now, my friend, Professor Craig Keener, one of the world's leading New Testament scholars, whose godliness and humility even exceeds his scholarship, although he'd be embarrassed with me saying that, when Craig got saved as a teenager, he got so hungry for the Word, he used to read the New Testament once a week and then the entire Bible once a month. So he spent a lot of hours in the Word. And there's no substitute, if you want to memorize, for repeatedly having something in front of you. Now, don't be discouraged if your mind works differently than others. Like my wife, Nancy, knows the Word very well. Great insight into the Scriptures. Knows a lot of material. Will reference things. Will quote things. But she normally can't tell you it's this chapter, this verse, like I can. So I learn things one way. She learns them another way. You may be more visual, more oral. It can work in different ways, but there's never a substitute for immersing yourself in Scripture. And it's a biblical principle to meditate the word day and night, Joshua 1, Psalm 1, which referred to reciting it, repeating it, muttering it over and again. So keep it before you. So I read the word a lot, and then I realized that when I spoke it, not just read it to myself, but when I spoke it and when I wrote it, that further deepened my ability to retain. So what I would do is this. When I wanted to memorize a verse or I wanted to memorize a particular section, I would do this. I would read the verse several times. Then what I would do is I would keep working at it until I could write it one time. Right? I'd keep working at it until I could write it one time. After writing it one time, I would then say it perfectly seven times. I had to say it perfectly seven times. Couldn't be six, couldn't be four. Had to be perfectly seven times, and I would check to make sure I had it perfectly. I wouldn't keep looking back. I'd say it. If I stumbled anyway, I'd correct it seven times, and then I would write it again. For years, I had this stack of, it was almost probably about 4,000 verses over this period of time, where it was each verse written out twice. So that's how I do it. I would write it out once, say it seven times, write it out, again, from memory, and then constantly be reading it. And then when I would be driving in my car, once I got to drive, when I'd be taking a walk, I would constantly be reciting scriptures, repeating scriptures, speaking them. So the immersion in it was probably the biggest thing of all. But then the speaking, the writing, the repeating was wonderfully important. Okay, before I get into more questions, let me give you this trivia question, and if you get the answer right, you will get, when it comes out, a free autographed copy of my book, A Queer Thing Happened to America, which is a $25 book, almost 500-page book, hardcover. We'll send it to you for free when it comes out. If you get this right now, it's not that easy. I didn't know who this individual was until last night. You are not allowed to use the internet to answer this question. Oh, does it take you a second? And if you try to cheat, you think God will bless you with a free book? Okay, so you can't search on your cell phone. You cannot use the internet. You have to dig. You have to use books. You have to ask people. All right, unless you know. And if no one gets it, then I'll give a hint, and maybe another day we may stretch this out till the book comes out. Who is Salmon P. Chase? Who is Salmon, spelled S-A-L-M-O-N? I imagine you pronounce the L because it's like Solomon. Salmon P., middle initial P., Chase. Who is he? That's your question, 866-34-TRUTH. Now, feel free to call in, as always, with your other questions that relate to issues relating to the line of fire. Anything that relates to Bible, Bible translation, theology, apologetics, Jewish people, Israel, moral, cultural things in America, or anything we've talked about on the air, feel free to call in. But that's your question. Who is, or was, he's not alive today. Who was Salmon P. Chase? All right, let's see here. This is from Sherry. When I was at a Bible study, it was brought up that it wasn't a rooster that cocked when Jesus was denied by Peter. I've seen various websites saying it was a temple crier. I wonder if there's any rabbinical documentation on this. My friend said I shouldn't trust everything I hear and that the Bible was to be taken literal, and the translation from the Greek indicates a rooster. Now, interestingly, I've actually been asked this question a couple times, which surprises me that it even comes up this much. But to answer this, everything we understand tells us it was a rooster. All right. Now, it's taken literally. Could it be that everyone knew in those days you couldn't have a rooster? Jews couldn't have a rooster in temple premises or in Jerusalem, and therefore there couldn't have been a rooster there. And no, well, we know the word means rooster, but could it have referred symbolically to something else? Rooster. Rooster is the right understanding, and there's no reason to say that. Look, Romans also had roosters, and there were roosters in Jerusalem, so it was a rooster, not a town crier. Oh, let's see. We've got an answer. Kendall in Greensboro. Do you think you have the answer to this?
I do indeed.
Oh, I'm impressed, man. Go ahead.
I believe Mr. Chase was the Secretary of State under Abraham Lincoln.
All right, Secretary of State under Abraham Lincoln. Tell you what, I'm going to put you on hold during the break. The information I have was slightly different than that, but let me check to see if he was also Secretary of State. But let's just say we could well be talking about the very same individual. So we'll stay on hold here, and I've got another call from California. I may give out two books. All right, well, that shows how little I know. If people immediately called in knowing this, I'd never heard of him until last night. We'll be back. Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast. All right, let me get another responder. I'm curious to know how these callers knew about Salmon P. Chase. Now, 866-34-TRUTH, sorry, let me give you the number, 866-348-7884, our website, AskDrBrown.org. I got a few interesting announcements and things to share with you. But again, it's the end of the week, so you've got questions, we've got answers. If you just tuned in, I asked a trivia question. And I'm giving away a couple of advanced copies of my book, A Queer Thing Happened to America. Well, we'll give them out when the book comes out next year, God willing. But my question was, who is Salmon P. Chase? And immediately, I mean, instantly, we got a couple of callers who had information for us. And I just want to ask our second caller, Jacob in Victorville, California. Jacob, how did you know who Chase was?
Well, it kind of deals with the last subject you're talking about, memorization. I was a history undergrad, and there's some things that just get in your head, and they never leave.
Yes, sir.
So, I knew that. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. And how was he presented when you were why was he a figure? Obviously, you didn't learn about every human being in American history. Why did he stick in your head?
Well, I studied specifically American history, and a lot of it was from the Civil War on, and I even took one of my classes was American Civil War. And then, you know, now I'm doing political science grad work. You kind of then you get to know the political figures more than you do, more than so than even the events in history. You get to know the people of history.
Yeah, and that's also a good way to learn it because it fleshes it out in a more human way. Hey, Jacob, thanks for the call. I'm going to read something from Harriet Beecher Stowe about it, so keep listening. You'll be interested to hear this in case you didn't know some of these details. God bless. Thanks, man.
All right. God bless.
All right. Okay. By the way, that's a good reason to walk in humility. Everyone that thinks you know a lot, people think I know a lot. In terms of available knowledge, I know what? 1 billionth of a trillionth of knowledge that's available. You know, so it's kind of silly to say, oh, this person knows a lot, or they're a great scholar. We some of us know a little bit more about certain areas than others. That's about it. So last night, I just picked up Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. I've read parts of it in the past, but never actually got into reading it seriously. So this is an edition. Of course, this is the famous book, the novel, that when Lincoln met her, he said, so this is the little lady who wrote the book that made this great war. All right? So there's an introduction by a contemporary author of a few decades back writing about the book, the significance of it. And then there's an introduction from Harriet Beecher Stowe where she goes further background. And, okay, let's see here. She's talking about the opposition that had to be overcome. It's some extraordinary statements here. And she wrote from a decidedly Christian viewpoint. She says here, Mr. Van Zandt, a Kentucky farmer, set free his slaves and came over and bought a farm in Ohio. Subsequently, from an impulse of humanity, he received and protected fugitive slaves in the manner narrated in Chapter 9 of Uncle Tom's Cabin. For this, he was seized, imprisoned, his property attached, and he was threatened with utter ruin. Salmon P. Chase, then a rising young lawyer in Cincinnati, had the bravery to appear as his lawyer. Listen carefully. This is a lawyer fighting for a client who has freed slaves, and the climate was so intensely pro-slavery. As he was leaving the courtroom, continuing Harry Peter Stowe's comments, after making his plea, one of the judges remarked, "There goes a young man who has ruined himself today," and the sentiment was echoed by the general voice of society. The case went against Van Zandt, and Mr. Chase carried it up to the Supreme Court of the United States, which, utterly ignoring argument and justice, decided against him. All right, so hang on. Here's a young attorney. He's now been told he ruined himself because he's fighting against slavery. Public opinion is against him. Courts are against him. He goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and he loses his case. Ah, there's more. But just a few years more, and Salmon P. Chase was himself Chief Justice of the United States. The sixth Chief Justice of the United States. Can you believe that? Does that speak to you? Does that encourage you to tell you do what's right and God can do the impossible? It was one of those rare dramatic instances in which courage and justice sometimes brings a reward even in this life. Wow. All right, I've got some wild posts that did not make it onto our website. You'll understand for obvious reasons. I'm going to read them to you in a moment. Someone questioned my friendship with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. We are public friends. We have just published public editorials in the Washington Post, passionately differing with one another's positions taken at the debate Monday night on homosexuality. And we go at each other very strongly. We've been in active communication behind the scenes, affirming our love and commitment to one another and our desire to continue to be friends and continue to debate the issues. But someone asked me, isn't friendship with the world opposition to Jesus? I replied simply this. I'm not a friend of the world. In fact, there are plenty of people in the world who hate me, revile me, mock me, despise me. In terms of the spirit of the world, I am absolutely not a friend of the world. I'm a friend of God by his grace. But I'm a friend of people in the world. I hope everybody is. I'm a friend of people that Jesus died for. I seek to follow his model, which is befriending those that others won't befriend. Now, Rabbi Shmuley is befriended by many, but I'm saying we would be theological opponents. We would be ideological opponents in some areas and in harmony on other areas. As many times as we've talked about, let's be a common voice for a certain moral principle, we end up just debating each other, okay? But by all means, the Jesus model is to be friends with people in the world, to love your neighbor. And I don't do it just for evangelistic purposes. I do it because I genuinely love these people. And that should be who we are. Friendship with the world, never. Friendship with the people in the world should be every day of our lives. Part of our life, part of our loving our neighbor, part of our outreach. All right, let me grab one question on the phone before I go back to the email, and then I will read those amazing posts, comments, that the posts of the week that never made it. All right, Seth in Denver, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hey, I just had a question for you. I was wondering, in Israel, what version of the Bible would like Messianic Jews or Christian Jews read? Because I've seen New Testaments in Hebrew and Tanakhs in Hebrew, but I haven't seen a combination of both.
Well, if you are a Messianic Jew in Israel and Hebrew is your first language, then you will use a Hebrew Tanakh, so it's the Hebrew Old Testament, although the Hebrew is a little bit different than modern Hebrew, in fact, very different in certain ways. So some Israelis struggle here and there with the language of the Tanakh, the ancient Hebrew. But if you grew up with that, that's what you would have. You'd have the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew Old Testament, and if you're a Messianic Jew, you'd have the modern translation of the Hebrew New Testament bound together. So you'd have the whole thing in Hebrew, and I've had those for years. There are some older translations by Delitzsch and Ginsburg and others of the New Testament that are more in an older kind of style.
Well,
go ahead.
I was wondering if you don't mind. I haven't found any of the combination Old Tanakh and New Testament. Sorry, Brit HaChadashah in combination. Maybe that's just because I'm not fluent in Hebrew, so I'm not able to search for it online. But on like eBay and all these other sites, I've seen the Tanakh and I've seen the Brit HaChadashah, but I've never seen them both together.
Yeah, best thing is to try to find a Christian bookstore in Israel. They'll absolutely have them. Otherwise, check with the possibility that the American Bible Society carries them, okay?
Anyway, also, I just thought it was strange that Christians in America read a different format than the Messianic Jews would read. I just think that's weird.
Yeah, well, it's same books, just different order here and there. All right, got to go.
Thanks.
We'll be back. Okay, just in case any of you don't understand that you can be a friend of individuals and work with them in many different ways without being a friend of the world, friend of individuals who are not believers in Jesus, without being a friend of the world. Lest any of you think that by my interaction with rabbis all the time and my friendship with rabbis and others that are not believers, in fact, I've had lunch with gay activists, lesbian activists, and sat and talked to them and heard their stories and reached out to them, lest somehow someone think that that thereby makes me a friend of the world. Let me read this post that came into Voice of Revolution but didn't. It was moderated, didn't make it on, obviously, because of its profanity, which I'm going to leave out, but was just sent to me so I could see. You know what, blank you, it is people like you who are tearing this country apart. You need to get your dumb blank off the radio. You and your followers are idiots. Gay people are not going to hell for being gay. I have a good idea why you don't get back on LSD, then you might be a halfway decent person and leave the gay people alone, you idiot. Multiple explanation points. I'm going to report you to the ACLU and have your blank in a lot of blanking trouble if you keep this blank up. If I hear on your so-called radio show, I guess this is not actually a radio show, just TV, and you're probably not picking up the TV signals. If I hear in your so-called radio show talking badly about gay people, I swear the ACLU will be on you so blank fast in the network who puts this blank out. So I dare you to blank with me. I know why you are so set on bashing gay people is because you're insecure and have nothing better to talk about. Let's not mention you're a closeted gay man yourself. I mean, this is a very lost person. I just have to laugh at the degree of thinking that they're right. Oh my, does it make you feel all big and bad to get on the radio and rant and rave like you do? I bet you won't say it to my face, big boy. Hey, buddy, I hope you're listening so you can hear your own words. I hope you get canceled. I'm going to say this to you. Your network and Fox News can all go to blanking hell where you can all rant and rave about whatever the blank you want. At least I will not have to hear it. By the way, you don't have to listen. Fred, you don't have to listen. Let's see, how wonderful it will be the day you are not allowed on the airwaves. Well, I can't wait. You call yourself a doctor. Well, can you heal someone? I don't think so. By the way, gay is great, and yes, bullying is bad, so stop doing it, retard. This was very fun for me, but I have better things to do now besides keep blanking with you. Bye, you blanking loser. Have fun on air tomorrow, blank boy. I will be listening and recording it for ACLU. Ha, 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 blank ass, blank, blank. Father, would you touch this guy and show him your love? We were all lost at one point and in need of your mercy. But for those that are concerned, I'm friends with the spirit of the world, fear not. Now here's a sad one. This didn't get on because it's a personal attack, and we don't allow that. Friend, you can't attack anyone. I'm more happy to take people posting personal attacks on me, but we just have a policy of no personal attacks. And it's not ethical. It's not righteous. It's not the place to be doing an internet forum anyway. This is from Rachel. This is a sad one because she's really projecting her own anger and hurt and pain in the name of grace, being extraordinarily judgmental, which I've seen. I've seen people who in the name of grace are cruel, mean-spirited, and it's painful and sad. I wrote an article last year called Appalling Grace, a response to Mark Galley's The Scandal of the Public Evangelical. If you never read it, go online, askdrbrown.org, and click on The Voice of Revolution and search for Appalling Grace. It's one of the more important articles I've written, actually. She wrote this: as one who has suffered under nothing but law-filled exhortation from the pulpit for years, I would far rather go to Galley's church than yours, Mr. Brown. You seem to treat the gospel like the flu, something to get over. By the way, where Rachel would get that idea is mind-boggling to me. The most wonderful subject in the world is the beauty of Jesus and his love and his goodness and mercy and compassion and his holiness and his purity and his perfection reaching out to us is overwhelmingly flooring to me. It's a message we bring around the world. But again, through Rachel's hurt eyes, she gets it differently. You seem to treat the gospel like the flu, something to get over. Your Pharisaism practically drips from your words. You clearly don't let grace speak but a moment before you nuance it to the point of elimination. Sadly, you'll read these comments like many self-righteous people do. As a confirmation that you were right because you're being persecuted, you probably need... Now, look, this is a hurting person writing. But I'm using this as an illustration of how people project from themselves and then throw it on others. And it's, you really need to search your own heart and get right with God before you do these kinds of things, so that you can speak words of grace that build up, not words that tear down. So this is what poor Rachel says. You probably need, one, a nervous breakdown, and two, a rediscovery of naked grace. So I really pray that God would reveal the depth of his grace to Rachel and bring healing to her soul, so that she will not be captive to the pent-up stuff that hurting her, causing her to lash out at others with anger, and not to understand that God's grace changes us. The message of grace is not keep on sinning and be forgiven all the more you sin. The message is be forgiven and be changed and helped. Which leads to this email inquiry from Jeb. I've heard two times in the last couple weeks, one on the Bible study at church and another on TV from Christians, that sin after being saved, if someone sins after being saved, they can lose their salvation. I heard that being saved is a daily thing that you have to do, a constant relationship with Jesus that saves you. So if you keep sinning, then you can lose your salvation after confession. Originally, what do you think? Can you lose your salvation? Of course, I've addressed this question many a time on the air. And I know that there are folks listening who hold passionately to once saved, always saved. I know there are folks listening who hold passionately to perseverance of the saints. I know folks who hold passionately to the idea you can lose your salvation. So let me try to say a few things that to me are indisputable scripturally. First is, you should never live in such a way of and by the way, it's so interesting, you know, that comment from Rachel that I just read to you in the context of what I'm going to say. You should never, ever live with the idea of, oh, no, am I saved? I'm not saved. I'm in. I'm out. Oh, he loves me. He doesn't love me. Oh, my name is written in the book of life. Oh, it's erased. Oh, it's in. I got saved again. No, that is absolutely not the heart of God. That is absolutely not the way he relates to you. That is absolutely not what the gospel is about. Absolutely. I want to make that as clear as possible. And even the most perfectly committed person in this world, serving the Lord with every fiber of their being, is still not totally perfect in God's sight and still falls short and still needs mercy and forgiveness. That being said, our sin grieves the Lord. Our sin hurts us. Our sin can break our fellowship. So our concentration should not be on our sin, but rather on intimacy with the Lord, on fellowship with the Lord, on learning his ways, coming to know him better, so that we can live lives that are holy and pleasing in his sight. What about losing salvation? I know some differ with me, but let me lay this out as clearly as I can. It's not a matter of, oh, I sinned one time too many. Oh, you know, I crossed that line. No, it is a matter of conscious, willful rejection of the gospel. If someone turns away from the Lord, rejects him, rejects his mercy, rejects his grace, refuses his lordship, that person has forfeited their salvation, as I understand scripture. But that should be of no concern to everyone listening that wants to please the Lord. And it should be a warning to those listening who hold to once saved, always saved, meaning I can do whatever I want and reject God, be an atheist serial killer, and I'm still in. You, my friend, need to repent and wake up. We will return with a question of Jewish mysticism. Hey, friends, welcome back to the Line of Fire broadcast. If you could be praying for us, we've got a couple of major trips, and we'll have some special radio programming and hopefully some live trips from overseas, but a trip to Israel, God willing, next week, ministering in some key congregations, pouring into leadership there, as well as doing an outreach lecture at Hebrew University. Some folks were trying to set up a debate with a rabbi there, but a rabbi not from Hebrew University, but a rabbi who would debate me at Hebrew University, he was encouraged not to do it by other rabbis. So that may not be happening, but I will be doing an outreach lecture, and then we'll also broadcast that, put that on YouTube subsequently. So if you could be praying for my trip to Israel, November 12th to 19th, and then the first week of December, my annual trip to India. And if you're able to help us with a gift, if you could support us in our endeavors to reach the lost sheep of the house of Israel, to touch the nations, and to be a voice here in America of moral sanity and spiritual clarity, You are literally enabling us to raise up missionaries that go around the world. You are literally enabling us to take the message of salvation to Jewish people, literally enabling us to confront our culture with the truth. Go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. If you've been blessed by the show, then you can show your appreciation by helping us in a tangible way. Askdrbrown.org. Click on support. Okay, there is an email from Andrew, and it has the letters PRDS, which mean, the moment I read the note, I knew exactly what he was referring to. It's an acronym, Pardes, which means garden in Hebrew. It's an acronym. The P stands for Pshat, which means the plain meaning of the text, the contextual narrative meaning. The R stands for Remez, which is hint, literally. It speaks of what the, I'm putting this in very simple terms, what the text could be hinting at beyond the plain sense. Then the D, another level deeper, stands for Drosh, which is the homiletical meaning. And then the S stands for Sod, which would be the mystical meaning. And the question is, I've heard that the four levels of teaching, these four levels, is from Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. What is the truth and where this paradigm toward understanding the scriptures come from? It predates Kabbalah, which in terms of its really organized form is many hundreds of years after Jesus. But it seems that these various levels of interpretation go back fairly anciently in Jewish history. Maybe not always laid out like this, but the idea that there are these different levels of interpretation, the rabbi said that every verse in Torah has 70 potential meanings, these types of concepts go back. And we know even in the New Testament, it may quote a verse from the Old Testament, from the Hebrew Scriptures, just in terms of its plain sense. It might quote it with a symbolic meaning or a typological meaning. It may quote it in a homiletical meaning. So these four categories were not necessarily fixed or known in this way in the first century as they were subsequently developed, but we have clear different levels of reading text in the Dead Sea Scrolls, within the rabbinic literature and the Talmud. So these things are certainly quite ancient as far as how far they go back, and they would therefore predate Kabbalah, which would then build specifically on the last, Sod, which refers to the mystical meaning of the text. All right, let me grab another call. Mike in Raleigh, thanks for calling the Line of Fire today.
Hey, Mr. Brown, how you doing?
I'm really blessed. Thank you.
Awesome, me too.
The reason I'm
calling you is because I've kind of had a, I guess it's sort of an ongoing situation in my life. I'm a 29-year-old single guy. I've been dating a girl for over a year, and I've kind of had a problem with the whole fornicating thing, and made it about 3 months without doing without fornicating, and it was just really stressful, and it seemed like there were a lot of it caused a lot of other problems. I know the Bible doesn't actually, people have actually told me the Bible doesn't actually say you can't have sex before you're married, but it says other things. What is your whole thought on the whole thing?
Yeah, Mike, it absolutely does say that you can't. Only sexual relations that are acceptable in God's sight are those within the context of marriage. And it says that everything else, including fornication, which it names by name, defiles us, makes us unclean, and is very much a sin against Jesus in a direct way, because we are joined together with him, all right?
Uh-huh.
We are joined together with him. Our bodies belong to him, and now we are taking those bodies and joining them with someone else. I'm sure there can be struggles. The big thing is not to get in a situation, Mike, that opens the door. In other words, you got to be at the wrong place with the wrong person for it to happen. Otherwise, it can't happen. And what I want to encourage you to do, if you stay on the line with Joey, our producer there, I'm going to give him a link to give you to a message of mine to listen to online that I think will help you. And then feel free to write to us privately, and we'll have someone from our ministry speak into your life some more. All right, Mike?
Thank you so much.
All right, stay on the line. Oh, more to come. Stay with us. I just want to comment a bit more on the call from a very honest caller Listen, if you have never struggled with sin, then you are not alive. I'm speaking to someone who was either never born or who is like 118 years old and has forgotten that you ever struggled with sin. But there's a battle. There are temptations. There are pressures. You can struggle with anger. You can struggle with bitterness. You can struggle with lust. You can struggle with lying. You can struggle with prayerlessness. You can struggle with any number of sins. And on a certain level, all of us have been there and done that. So I appreciate the candor of our caller. He's saying he's single. If you're married and commit sexual sin outside of wedlock, you're married and you commit sin outside of your marriage, that's adultery. If you commit sexual sin before marriage, that is fornication. But I want to encourage all of you to go to this. Hang on. Joey, I seem to hear some music playing. What was that? Was that just spontaneous fire playing in the midst of the show? But Mike, as you're still on the line listening, here's what you do. Go to my website, askdrbrown.org, okay? Go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org, and just look for resources, all right? When you see resources, click on free resources, and you'll see them on subjects like Israel, revolution, revival, spiritual growth. And if you go to the section on revival, you will see some messages that will help you specifically on holiness, etc. But here's the one I want you to listen to. All right, this is from Mike and others. It's the strongest holiness truth from Scripture God's ever given me, eye-opening in terms of the final consequences of sin and the final rewards of righteousness. I'm telling you, it has saved many lives. It's been a truth that saved my own life. And it's based on one Hebrew word, acharit, from Scripture. So here's what you do. Ask Dr. Brown. .org, everybody there, or just mark it down. Click on resources. I'm taking time on this because there's someone's life here we're dealing with, all right? Click on resources, and then you'll see free resources. We've got our online bookstore, then our free resources, and you'll see a message under the subject of revival. Just scroll down, all right? Scroll down under audio, and you'll see Acharit, the final end. It's under the A's, A-H-A-R-I-T, Acharit, the final end. And what I'm going to do is, if Mike, you give your email address to Joey, all right? You give your email address to Joey, we will send you the specific link to listen to. But I say that for everybody else. All right, we are out of time. And I, what I'm going to be doing, God willing, in the next couple of weeks is answering a lot more questions that come in and doing some teaching about some of the different subjects. But I want to come back to something of critical importance. It is this, and this is my bottom line for today. It is one thing to be a lover of the world, to love the things of the world, the carnal things, the fleshly things, the earthly things, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life. It is one thing to be a friend of the world, and therefore, in the words of James, Jacob, to be adulterers and adulteresses because we are sinning against God. And to be a friend of the world means to bow down to the system of the age, to compromise with this world, to mingle light with darkness. That's being a friend of the world, to love the fleshly things of this world, to cater to carnality. And God forbid that any of us are friends of the world or love the world. But there is loving the world, as in for God so loved the world, meaning the people in the world, which requires, and by love from our hearts, mandates being friends with people in the world. Befriend people that differ with you. Befriend people that disagree with you. Befriend those that think you're crazy. Reach out to them with the love of Jesus and make him known. Have an awesome weekend.